Yeah, but first of all, I just want to say I'm really so pleased to have been invited to come and give a talk here. Well, just to come, actually. I've heard so much at different times, both from Vanaraji and other people, about this centre, and I've always been curious, interested, and been very impressed, you know, by what I hear about, you know, the involvement and the engagement with all of you here, and I just think it's so beautiful. I think you've done a fantastic job, collectively and individually, in getting it to this state. It's very impressive, and yeah. So thanks, thanks for inviting me, and I'm really glad to be here and with Mudita Shri. Yeah. So. Yes, the title of my talk, as I haven't come up with a personal title, but the title that I was given was Communicating Through Symbols, The Wheel of Life, The Hub. So this evening we're looking at one way in which the Buddha taught through symbol. And I'd really like to thank Laura in her absence for creating this beautiful of the Wheel of Life, to give me, which gives me the opportunity to point things out. In Sanskrit, the term for the Wheel of Life is Bhava Chakra, which translates literally as the Wheel of Becoming. So we're always becoming, aren't we? Moment by moment by moment. Our life is a life of becoming. And it sounds like you had an evocative talk from Vidyadhara last week, was it? On myth and symbol, which I was sorry to miss hearing myself. And Vanaraji told me some things about it. And apparently he brought home the difference between Wikipedia mind and the mind which responds to myth and symbol, which you could call the poetic mind or the imaginative mind. And perhaps there's a very, obvious difference or overt difference in experience between looking at this very rich and colourful symbol. I hope you can all see it. Don't know if any of you want to move so you can see it. The difference between looking at this very rich and colourful symbol and perhaps listening to Jnanavacha's talk, which you had earlier on dependent arising, and Srivati's on the three marks of conditioned existence. The ways in which the Buddha communicated through concepts. So knowing Jnanavacha and Srivati as I do, I'm sure these were also very rich and imaginative talks because they're both very good speakers. But for many people in Tibet, because this is where we find this symbol most commonly, for many people in Tibet particularly, just the symbol itself, the image gave the teaching. The image gave the teaching. It was a constant reminder in shrine rooms, on the walls of monasteries, in people's houses, in eating houses, cafes. There would be very, very often a Wheel of Life. And it was so familiar to the Tibetan people that it was a teaching in itself. So how did this image emerge? Well, I'm going to tell you a story. So it's a story from a collection which is called Divya Vadana collection, which translates as divine narratives. So the collection of divine narratives. And this apparently stems from the second century of the Common Era, so a very old text. And it's about the Buddha and his and the emergence of this image. So the Lord Buddha was staying at Rajagaha, where he often stayed, in the bamboo grove at the squirrel's feeding place. Now, it was the practice of Venerable Mahamoggallana. Now, Venerable Mahamoggallana was one of the Buddha's foremost disciples. And it was his practice, it says in the text, to frequent the hells for a certain time, then the animal kingdom, also to visit the ghosts, the gods, and human beings. And having seen all the sufferings to be found in the hells, having witnessed how animals kill and devour others, how ghosts are tormented by hunger and thirst, how the gods lose their heavenly state, fall from it, are spoiled and come to their ruin, and how human beings crave and come to nothing but thwarted desires. So basically, Mahamoggallana has experienced all these states that are depicted in this circle of the Wheel of Life. The hell realms, the god realm, the animal realm. So we don't know exactly how he's experienced some, whether it's just states of his own mind that he's observed in the past, or whether he's actually had these kind of magical powers that he's been able to to visit other realms, as it were. But it just doesn't matter for the moment. It's a story. So having seen all this, he returned to India and reported this to the four assemblies of monks and nuns. And it says, whatever monk had a fellow bhikkhu, a fellow monk, or a monk pupil leading the holy life with dissatisfaction, so whenever there was a monk or a nun or one of the followers of the Buddhas who was leading the holy life but had dissatisfaction, he would take him to the Venerable Mahamoggallana, thinking, the Venerable Mahamoggallana will exhort and teach him well. And it says that such dissatisfied practitioners would again lead the holy life with keen interest, even distinguishing themselves with the higher attainments, since they had been taught and exhorted so well by the Venerable Mahamoggallana. And so at that time, when the Buddha was visiting Rajagaha, he noticed that the Venerable Mahamoggallana was surrounded by all these people, listening to him, talking to him. Bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, that's monks and nuns, laymen and laywomen. And the enlightened one, the Buddha, asked the question, why the second of his foremost disciples was surrounded by so many people. And Ananda, who was always accompanied the Buddha, told the Buddha that Mahamoggallana instructed discontented practitioners with success. And then the Buddha said, but the elder Moggallana, or someone like him, cannot be in many places at the same time for teaching people. Therefore, in the monastery gateways, a wheel having five sections should be made. And the Lord Buddha explained, then it was somebody said, but the bhikkhus do not know what sort of wheel should be made. So the Buddha explained, the five realms should be represented. It then became six realms, just to let you know. The five realms should be represented. The hellish realm, that of the animal kingdom. The realm of ghosts, of the hungry ghosts. Creatures who are always hungry but can't satisfy their hunger. While in the upper portion, the gods and human beings should be represented. And in the middle, this hub of the wheel, greed, aversion and delusion must be shown. A cock symbolizing greed, a snake symbolizing aversion, and a pig symbolizing delusion. And furthermore, the Buddhas are to be painted. Are the Buddhas there? Yes, the Buddhas are here. The Buddhas are to be painted. So enlightened beings are to be painted, pointing out the way to Nirvana. The space around the rim, this space, should be filled with scenes teaching the 12 links of dependent arising, which I'm going to have to leave you with because you have had a talk on that. And it must show clearly that everything, all the time, is swallowed by impermanence. And then he says the following two verses should be added as an inscription. So these are the verses. Make a start. Leave behind the wandering on. Firmly concentrate on the Buddha's teaching. As he, the leader like an elephant, did rout the mad elephant Nalagiri, so should you rout and defeat the hosts of death. Whoever in this Dharma Vinaya, this path of the Dharma, will go his way or her way, ever vigilant and striving hard, can make an end of suffering here and leave behind samsara's wheel of birth and death. So thus, at the instance of the bhikkhus, it was laid down by the Lord, by the Buddha, that the wheel of wandering on with five sections should be made in the gateways of monasteries. And then there's a little bit at the end, which is quite funny. So now the Brahmins and the householders would come and ask, Reverend Sir, what is this painting about? And the monks would reply, we also do not know. And thereupon the Buddha advised, a bhikkhu should be appointed to receive visitors in the gateway and to show them the mural. But bhikkhus were appointed without due consideration to be the guest receiver. Foolish, erring, confused persons without merit. At this it was objected, they themselves do not know. So how will they explain the wheel picture to visiting Brahmins and householders? And the Buddha said, a competent bhikkhu should be appointed. So I hope I'm sufficiently competent to tell you something a bit more, but particularly about this hub of the Wheel of Life. So, you know, what do we make of this story? Is it a legend? Is it a later interpolation put into the scriptures? But whether or not it was taught by the Buddha, it is what's called Buddhavachana. So Buddhavachana literally means the word of the Buddha, the word of the Buddha that's recognized as authentic teachings. But it can also be any teaching that is doctrinally authentic, that is, that's in accord with the authentic teachings. So this Wheel of Life is definitely Buddhavachana. It's definitely in accord with the Buddha's teachings. So it's an extraordinary symbol which portrays the human condition. All life and death is included, all aspects of human experience, suffering and pleasure. The law of karma, the effects of our actions, skillful and unskillful, the ways in which we create samsara, the state of dissatisfaction and frustration, and also the point of freedom. Which is I don't recognize the images so well here. I'll come back to that. So the point of freedom is the way in which we can break the cycle and emerge from what are described as the rounds of birth and death, the habitual or reactive mind, and move onto what is called the Dharma, the spiral path. So out of here, this point of freedom, can emerge a spiral path, or the creative mind, with the potential of accumulative states of calm, joy, absorption, generosity, leading to profound states of wisdom and compassion and unobstructed energy. So this evening I can only give you this taste of the wheel as a whole, which I hope won't leave you frustrated, but I think you're having further talks that will, yes, explain it more fully. So my task tonight is to focus on the hub, the symbol at the hub of the wheel, this remarkable image of these three creatures, the cock, the snake and the pig, who are biting each other's tails. So it doesn't quite show it all together here, but they are, the tail of each creature is in the mouth of the other creature. So usually the force which drives a wheel is external, some external engine or the force of a waterfall or a strong current of water. But in the wheel of life, of our lives, the wheel of our lives, it is these three creatures locked together which are the driving force which creates samsara, the world of simply dissatisfaction or of actual suffering. And these three creatures symbolize greed. The cock symbolizes greed or craving. The snake symbolizes hatred or aversion. And the pig symbolizes ignorance or delusion. And I've given the actual Pali names of these creatures, or these states of mind, rather. That looks a better drawing than mine. So the cock is labha, greed or craving. The snake is dvesa, hatred or ill will. And the pig, it's not a very good pig, is moha, which is delusion. So the reason I've given these names, the Sanskrit names, is or the Pali names. Anyway, the names is that because their particular meanings are not always fully translated by the English, but I'll come back to that. But they drive the wheel of life because it's our states of mind and our actions proceeding from these states of mind which create our world. I'm sure you're very, very familiar with the first two lines of the Dhammapada. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If we speak or act with an impure mind, suffering follows, even as the cart wheel follows the hoof of the ox which draws the cart. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If we speak or act with a pure mind, happiness follows, like a shadow which never departs. So the cock, the snake, and the pig, symbolizing greed, hatred, and delusion, are depicted in the center because they are the root causes for experience in the wandering on. I really like that phrase, the wandering on. You know, wandering on in a state of mind which is confused, unclear, and distracted, and a wandering on, which I'm sure we're all familiar with in our lives. I certainly am. Yes. When they are present in our hearts, greed, hatred and delusion, when they are present in our hearts, then we live afflicted. We live in samsara. But when they are not there, if they are temporarily allayed, if we are experiencing generosity, goodwill and a dharmic perspective, then we will be on this spiral path. And if craving, hatred and delusion are destroyed altogether through transcendental wisdom, then we are in the mind stream of enlightenment, or spontaneous compassionate activity, otherwise known as nirvana. So this is why, when we are ordained into the Tri Ratna Buddhist Order, we take 10 precepts, and 3 of those precepts are called the mind precepts. And they are a commitment to make the spiritual effort to abandon covetousness or craving for tranquility, to change hatred into compassion, and to transform ignorance into wisdom. So that's the commitment that we make, part of the commitment that we make at ordination, to really try to make the effort to practice those mind precepts, to change, to work with, and gradually change our states of mind. So samsara and nirvana are not places outside of us. We either ourselves, we either samsarize or we nirvanize, you could say. It's through our actions, through our mental states and our actions, that we create samsara or nirvana. So I'm going to go just into a bit more detail with each of these creatures. So Lobha, the cock. with his long claws and his fiery red coxcomb, his sharp curved beak, always strutting, restless, eyes seeking out, head in constant motion. I was trying to really get the feel of the cock when I was writing this, and I thought, oh, they go like this, don't they? So they're never still, there's always something they're looking out for. Yes, turning from side to side, lording it over his hens, protecting his territory, the cock has the connotations of arrogance and lust. So he represents greed, lobha. So all kinds of I wish, I want, I must have, I will have. And that extends from passionate desires, craving objects as possessions, attachments to people, to personality, to status, to views and ideas, and even a subtle clinging to the spiritual pleasure experienced in meditation. So you know how you want to have that experience again. You had a good meditation, you sort of felt quite expansive, you didn't notice any noises in the room because you were quite absorbed, and then the next time you sit, you want it, and quite often what happens is you don't get it. And part of the reason you don't get it is because of the craving, because you've already introduced the craving. So then there's just a little verse by Ryokan, which you might have heard before. I want this, I want that, is nothing but foolishness. I'll tell you a secret. All things are impermanent. I want this, I want that, is nothing but foolishness. I'll tell you a secret. All things are impermanent. And reflecting on impermanence is a traditional antidote to craving. The wheel of life, as we know, is clutched in the jaws of the monster of impermanence, to really bring that home to us as much as possible. But we also need to distinguish between the cock, lobha, or craving. So the state of mind which involves desiring pleasure from the object one is drawn to or attached to. So this is specific to lobha. This particular description of craving involves desiring pleasure from the object one is drawn to or attached to. But there's also another term for craving, which is trishna or thirst, and that's usually the term that's used here in the Wheel of Life. So trishna or thirst you can also talk about as the fever of unsatisfied longing. I really like that expression, the fever of unsatisfied longing. And if you like, that is the general condition that all of us unenlightened beings find themselves in the world. So a state of being characterized by a thirst that compels a pursuit for appeasing that thirst. The primary reason why samsara is deemed ultimately to be unsatisfactory, or dukkha, is that samsara cannot fully quench that thirst. So it's like, we're always wanting, we're on a kind of, well, I'm sure, why are you here? Why are all of you here? You're here because you've got a quest somehow. There's something you're looking for that's over and above your, as it were, ordinary everyday life. There's something that you have an intuitive connection with, that when you come here, that intuitive connection is kind of ignited, and you can feel you're in the right place, and there's something here that is important and significant, and you want to, you want to have more of it. So that's also a kind of thirst, isn't it? Mm-hmm. That's also a kind of thirst. And that kind of thirst can also have the outcome of liberation. So there's a distinction made between what's called karma chanda and dharma chanda that we may be familiar with. So there's a thirst for the pleasures of the senses, which is karma chanda, and then there's a thirst for the dharma in whatever form that might take. It might take the form of, just being aware of the level of friendship in this sangha. It can just be an attraction and being drawn to that kind of friendship, the spiritual friendship in the sangha. Or it can be a real thirst to penetrate the Dharma, to really study and understand more clearly what it is that the Buddha was teaching. That is a thirst that can have the outcome of liberation, of freedom. And there's a quote here, and I'm afraid I can't remember where it's from. I think it's from Sagramati, who's one of the scholars. He's an order member, who's one of the scholars of our order. And he says, the shift from the ignoble to the noble quest, so that's how that's sometimes described, is the shift from karma chanda to dharma chanda, from the thirst for sense pleasures to the thirst for the dharma. If the shift from the ignoble to the noble quest is not a matter of restraining that wish, that quest, that need, that thirst, or of attempting to annihilate it, but it arises as a consequence of reflection, reflecting on the fact that the life one is leading leaves one's basic desire for fulfillment unsatisfied. So we're not saying by talking about overcoming labha or craving, we're not talking about trying to do away with, annihilating or suppressing, repressing that thirst, that quest for freedom, for liberation, for the Dharma. So in the cock's beak, doesn't quite show it here, but on the other representations you'll see it, is the tail of the green snake. hatred or ill will, or otherwise called dvesha, dvesha. And the snake, well, I was trying to imagine, yeah, what is a snake? We can often be quite afraid of snakes, can't we? So the snake can be seen as wily. It's kind of sinuous, isn't it? Its movement is like this. And it's deceptive in that it's difficult to spot until you're upon it, and then it can suddenly strike. And a snake kills by poison or by strangulation. And this is what dvesha, or hatred or ill will, does if it grows in our own hearts. It poisons us. Hatred poisons us. So, you know, another way of talking about this, about dvesha, is to talk about it in terms of aversion. So whether that's immediate frustration or anger, or a slow burning resentment and hostility, that aversion springs up when we don't get what we want, or we get what we don't want. Either way, we don't get what we want, or we get what we don't want. So this aversion is the almost inevitable reaction to frustrated craving. Hence, the snake and the cock are bound together. So that's what, if we don't get what we want, it causes us suffering. And out of that, the reaction can be one of aversion, hatred, anger. So what's important to recognize here is that hatred and ill will follows on from suffering. The suffering of frustration, of not getting what we want, and getting what we don't want. So it's not enough just to think of getting rid of craving, the underlying cause. We need to respond to our own suffering with empathy and kindness before tackling the craving. You know, we're not going to stop craving for something if we're not taking ourselves into account. Otherwise, we'll respond to the craving with hatred, basically taking up a hateful attitude towards ourselves. So the snake bites the tail of this pig. They're sort of slightly different in other images. Who in turn bites the tail feathers of the cock of craving. And the pig symbolises moha, moha delusion. So we're unable, because of ignorance, to distinguish between what is skillful and what is unskillful. And there's a clinging to this state of moha, which is like a state of mental disorder, to wrong views and stubbornly refusing to recognise evidence to the contrary. So moha is pig-headed. The delusion of moha is pig-headed. It's a stubborn refusal to recognise evidence to the contrary. It's a clinging to that state of delusion. You know, not wanting to change, not wanting to see the truth. And I think this is brought out by definitions of the English translation of ignorance and delusion, because ignorance is defined as a lack of information. If we're ignorant, we have a lack of information. If we're deluded, it's described as a belief or impression that is firmly maintained despite being contradicted by what is generally accepted as reality. And typically, it's a symptom of a mental disorder. So that's how moha is described. It's not simply ignorance, a lack of information. It's not the ignorance of the first stage of this circle of the wheel. It's not just ignorance of the teachings of the Dharma. It's this stubborn refusal to open our eyes or to take in the understanding of how reality really is. So there we have it. The three root causes of our wandering on in samsara. So our state of delusion causing us to grasp after things for happiness and security, which cannot give us that happiness and security, except maybe for fleeting moments. The dissatisfaction caused by that, or the frustration caused by not being able to get what we want, resulting in feelings of aversion and ill will or hatred. And this hatred and craving, in turn, further compounding our state of delusion. So this is what drives the wheel. Yes. So what do we do? How can we practice to uproot these three causes of our suffering, these creators of samsara? Well, you'll be pleased to know that the Dharma has the answer. So what we need to do is we need to develop alobha, advesha, and amoha. So when there's the an A at the beginning of the, in front of the term, it means not. So this means, alobha means non-attachment, advesha means non-hatred, and amoha means non-delusion. So we begin with non-hatred, advesha. So non-hatred is simply non-reactivity to suffering. Non-reactivity to suffering. So it's obviously easier to say than to do. So it's, if you like, it's about stopping, taking a deep breath, being like in one famous text, the Bodhicaryavatara, it says, become like a block of wood. So you're experiencing suffering, the impulse is to blame something or somebody for your suffering, and in that instance, the practice is to be like a block of wood, or to take a deep breath, to stop, to bring in patience, shanti, to bring in patience. And patience, shanti, always involves metta. Where there's patience, there's metta. And also what's needed is the willingness to experience that unsatisfactoriness of suffering. Not masochistically in any way, but just because it's there. It's what's going on. So we need to have the willingness to just let that in, to let in how we're feeling and what we're experiencing. And this is otherwise known as staying in the gap. I'm sure, again, you've heard that phrase. Staying in the gap. And now here we come to it, the gap. Staying in the gap between feeling and craving. Or is it here? Can't quite work out the images here. Between feeling and craving. Sensation, feeling, craving. So a very well-known teaching of the Buddha and a very well-known teaching in Triratna. It's the point of freedom where we can move off the wheel onto the spiral path. And Pema Chodron talks about being in this gap where we're experiencing our experience, which may be painful or pleasurable, but if we're experiencing, if it's a painful experience, we just stay with that experience. We don't try and distract from it, we don't try and avoid it. if it's a pleasurable experience, we don't just try and grab at the thing we think will give us more pleasure. So we stay in the gap, experiencing the dukkha, if that's what it is. And Pema Chodron refers to this gap as the place of the spiritual warrior. Just being able to stay with the experience we're having. And Bhante Sangharakshita says that to remain in the gap between feeling and craving is victory over 1,000 men 1,000 times. So putting it in a more sort of military analogy. But it's just trying to express the hugeness of how important that ability is. The ability to remain in the gap between feeling and craving is what allows us to move off this wheel. So that's Advaita. And then Alobha, non-attachment, which is not detachment. It's not about not caring. It's not about not treasuring what's truly precious to us. It's the recognition that what we often think will give us fulfillment and pleasure will do so only temporarily, to be followed by another wave of dissatisfaction and renewed craving. But non-attachment, alobha, in its fullness, can be open. There's no fear of anything being taken away, no threats, so no threatening objects. It can be a state of individuality, independence, freedom, and creativity. And it's traditionally known as the basis for accomplishing good deeds. So it says in the texts, when a good mind is born, whatever may be its object of perception, it always manifests itself as non-attachment in regard to existence and non-irritation in regard to suffering. So this ability to not to react, not to grab on, not to grasp what we think will give us fulfillment and pleasure, is the basis for accomplishing good deeds, because we're not just taken up with this grasping mind. Our mind is open. It's able to see what's going on in a situation. We're able to see what's needed. We're able to see how to respond. And then there's amoha. There's non-delusion. Non-delusion, which is a kind of practical wisdom. So it's a clarity of mind, so following on from what I've just said, a clarity of mind that sees what is to be done in a particular situation, and it sees what is to be done for the good of all in that situation. And overall, it's the ability to distinguish what is skillful from what is unskillful. So that's what's lacking in moha, in delusion. In the state of delusion, we can't distinguish what's skillful and what's unskillful. But amoha is this practical wisdom, and it arises through maturing of the natural intelligence one is born with, through listening, reflecting, meditating, through Dharma study, reflecting, relating the Dharma to one's own experience and developing a spiritual intuition. That can really know quite clearly how to respond skillfully or to a situation. So I'm just going to conclude by saying that there is another version of the story of how the Buddha came to communicate this image of the Wheel of Life. I'm just going to finish with that very brief story. So according to this story, at the time of the Buddha, King Uddiyana offered a gift of a jeweled robe to King Bimbisara of Magadha. But King Bimbisara was concerned that he did not have anything of equivalent value to offer as a gift in return. So he went to the Buddha for advice. You can see that the Buddha was asked for all sorts of advice, including what present to give to your friend or relative. And the Buddha gave instructions to have the first drawing of the Wheel of Life, the Bhava Chakra, made. And he told Bimbisara to send the drawing to King Uddiyana. And it is said that the King Uddiyana attained realization through studying this drawing. So he didn't even necessarily need to have it explained to him. He just sat, surveyed it, absorbed it, reflected on it, let it speak to him. And through that, he attained realization. Yeah. Oh, thank you. Can I just add something?
Yes.
Because of course I haven't talked about this is a progression, right? So I mentioned that as order members we take 10 precepts at ordination, and three of those are called the mind precepts, and those precepts are abandoning covetousness for tranquility. I purify my mind. Changing hatred into compassion, I purify my mind. Transforming ignorance into wisdom, I purify my mind. So this is the commitment we make to practice towards. But clearly, it's not going to be that easy to jump from craving to tranquility, to what I've put here as pasadi or abhijja. I couldn't find the exact term for this, but it's not that easy to jump from craving to tranquility. It's not easy to jump from ill will or aversion to compassion, and it's not easy to jump from delusion to pranya, to wisdom. But these are non-attachment, non-hatred, and non-delusion, they are doable. We can do those. We really, really can. You know, we can not react in the moment, even if it's only once in a day, and, you know, 10 times in the day you do react. That once in a day makes the difference. If we can be aware that maybe we're in a study group, you know, a Dharma study group, and we're hearing something, and we say, "Well, I'm not gonna do that. I'm all right as I am," or whatever it is. This sort of stubbornness, pig-headedness is such a good term. This pig-headedness to not want to hear what can help us change, we can let go of that pig-headedness just once in a while and try something out. You know, we could experiment with something and see if it makes a difference. And in terms of non-craving or non-attachment, well, again, it is possible. Just to notice when we have that feeling, oh, you know, I'm just going to go online for a moment because I really want to look at those shoes that are on sale. And I know I've got a good pair of shoes, but those other shoes were really nice. I saw them on my friend and I really liked them, whatever it is, you know. And we could just notice well, what's going on there? What's going on? Is there something going on in ourselves? Are we not feeling very happy at the moment? Are we feeling a bit at a loose end? Don't quite know what to do with ourselves? Are we not enjoying things very much at the moment? And do we really think that that extra pair of shoes is going to do it for us, you know? So we can just notice the feelings coming into being, and we can just decide to do something different in that moment. So all these small actions of non-craving, non-hatred, and non-delusion, all these small actions, they do add up, they accumulate, they have an effect. Well, you've been hearing, haven't you, about conditionality, and that everything we do, you know, both skillful and unskillful in our actions of body, speech, and mind, everything has an effect in some way or other. So those small actions do have an effect, and they will make a difference. And especially if we can, in a way, just notice them and articulate them, maybe we can just tell our friends, you know, that we just did something different on that occasion and it had this particular effect. So we can kind of articulate it and make it more conscious.